Welcome to Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 5, Episode 5, presented by Marketile. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
Well, Steve, we are one degree away from celebrity here with our very special guest on the show, Christine Day, co-founder and president of the House of LR&C, fantastic apparel retailer based on love, care, and respect. And the celebrity element is football, her partners in this, football star Russell Wilson and entertainer Ciara combined their passion for design and fashion and Christine's deep, deep expertise. It's a really fantastic interview.
Yeah, we both heard Christine when we were out at Shop Talk, and I honestly did not know too much about the brand at the time. I've learned a little bit more about it, and of course, people will hear more about it when we get to that interview in just a few minutes. But as people will also hear, she has some pretty amazing experience with a couple of brands that people might have heard about. So I thought it was both a interesting story about an up-and-coming remarkable retailer, but also some really great leadership lessons for everybody. Mm-hmm. So glad to get her on.
Speaking of Las Vegas, we're going to be back in Las Vegas at Grocery Shop in September. And exclusive for our listeners, we've got a Grocery Shop discount code, RBR1950. We'll put this in the show notes with all the terms and conditions and all the fun stuff and what you get, and valid only for retailers and brands. But we look to see you all there. We're going to be doing interviews and chitting and chatting. So looking forward to being with you again in Las Vegas. All right, let's get to our news. So as we have been doing for the past, couple episodes, right? Let's start with some economic news. I mean, we had some good news, which is nice, this week. Talk about what your impression is about the U.S. jobs report.
Yeah, we're recording this on Friday, and this morning there was a very, very positive, way better, I guess, than most people expected, jobs report. The U.S. created, I think it was something like 525,000 new jobs. Unemployment is down to 3.5%. So we're in this weird vortex we've talked about a couple of times where we've got this big slowdown in many aspects of spending, two quarters of GDP going down, yet this incredibly robust job market. In fact, one of the things I saw this morning was, I think it's in about 20 months, we've gone from 17% or something in that vicinity unemployment to 3.5%, 17 million new jobs. I mean, it's, that part of the economic story is incredible, incredibly positive. Income also up, yet lots of inflation, lots of slowdown. So it's, again, this really interesting combination of forces, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, that kind of number, 3%, I mean, thinking back to my basic economics that I learned in school, I mean, with frictional unemployment, you know, people moving around, that's basically full employment. And so it's rare that you'd get these two things going together. And I guess it harkens back when I saw the news back to our early episodes where we're like, stay humble, stay agile, because this is something new. And at the same time, you read this great news, but for example, there's some not so great news with retailers, starting with Walmart.
Yeah, Walmart announced, a couple of hundred, which is not significant. I mean, obviously important to the people affected, but not huge into a company as big as Walmart. But they announced a couple hundred people being laid off at their corporate headquarters. As we talked about, I think last week, Walmart's been guiding lower in terms of their overall performance. We'll hear about their earnings in a couple of weeks' time, I guess. And then another big retailer, Under Armour, which had been doing pretty well for a while, also guided quite a bit lower. So we kind of get this tale of two cities of some things of which look quite positive, and then a lot of retailers which are really, you know, tapping the brakes in many cases are actually not doing so well.
Well, I think it's more than tapping the brakes, but I saw you on social media talking about our friends at Wayfair. They're more hitting the wall than tapping the brakes at this point.
Well, some people will know that I've not been a fan of Wayfair. I mean, I think it's not that I'm anti-Wayfair, but I think the business model has been very questionable. In fact, I think I may have disclosed this on the in some episode of the podcast, maybe the last time Wayfair had earnings. But I guess just to back up for a second, Wayfair reported earnings. Their sales were down quite a lot. Their active customer base was down quite a lot. They had a $300-something million loss, which was a huge switch from a year ago. So very, very bad performance. I think it's not surprising at one level, given the slowdown in the home market overall.
Sure. I mean, RH is warning as well, right?
Not a great surprise that the top line wasn't so good. But here's a company that's been in business for almost 20 years that hasn't come close to making a profit except for a few quarters during COVID, where it turned out most of their competitor stores were closed. So it turns out that's actually pretty good for grabbing market share. So
it is a tough strategy to replicate, though.
It is a tough, right. It's very hard. It's hard to say that that's sustainable and stay out of jail. But I wrote an article for Forbes about 4 years ago where I really questioned the Wayfair business model, because it seemed to me, number one, that they were spending a crazy amount of money on marketing. Number two, their gross margin was several hundred basis points below what seemed possibly sustainable. And, you know, I just question how big the addressable market was for their particular merchandise mix. Now, they got, you know, to the extent you can say COVID gave them a gift, as I mentioned, they got this bump from the big shift to online. But really, since we've kind of opened up a bit more, the business or the news financial performance has been terrible. And they're at a place where going forward, you know, it doesn't look like the revenue picture is going to be very good for some period of time. So it's a real question as to how they're going to right the ship. But it's been several quarters now of really bad news. And I don't see that they've articulated anything that gives anybody a bunch of confidence that they're going to turn this thing around. Stocks off, I think 75% year to date, something like that. So
yeah, train wreck. That's not new news, but the new news about the loss in customers is particularly troubling or vexing, or whatever you want to call it, right? Because that's that downshifts growth. Let's talk about what did you call them? Wobbly unicorns.
Did
you come up with that?
I didn't. I'd like to say that I did, but that would not be honest. And no, we try to have integrity above all on the Remarkable Retail podcast. Yeah. No, I forget where I saw it. I should have gone on the internet to try to track it down. But yeah, I saw somebody refer to some of these digitally native vertical brands that had very high valuations in the not too recent past that now look quite wobbly. We're actually going to see, I think maybe the day that this comes out, Warby Parker reports, Allbirds will report the Real. So we'll have earnings to talk about there next week. But in the meantime, Allbirds, I think, already signaled it's not going to be a good quarter by announcing some layoffs and some other strategies to improve and try to improve their performance. Glossier had some additional layoffs. They're also, which I think is a good move for them, going to be partnering up with Sephora to expand some of their products into wholesale. So using Simeon Siegel's term, our friend, taking the D out of DTC.
I love that.
But not a new strategy. I mean, we've seen other brands, including Allbirds, pursue Casper, wholesale partnerships.
Long list of folks who give up on strictly going direct and partner with retailers. It's not a short list, and it's not an incorrect strategy, really, for growth.
Yeah, I think it, you know, remains to be seen how it will work out. But as we talked about on some prior episodes, again, a lot of these brands that have gone public have seen their valuations come down a lot. And going into these economic headwinds could be pretty interesting to see how they're going to navigate these probably pretty choppy waters for at least several more quarters. So watch this space.
But we are seeing some machinations and movement around logistics and savvy retailers, Target and Best Buy, adjusting the way they're delivering. That caught your attention. We were talking about this off mic. That caught your attention. We were thinking about our Nancy King episode from season four. Talk about your observations about what Target and Best Buy are up to.
Well, Target is continuing to expand these sortation centers, I think they're sometimes called, but new delivery hubs. So I would encourage people to go back and listen to our interview with Nancy King, because she really explains this story. So just the quick backdrop there is Target has, I think, roughly 20% of their business that's ordered online, but 96% or in that range, we'll see next quarter what it looks like, but a really, really high percentage that is fulfilled from stores. And so they've been creating this hybrid distribution system that allows them to get products to customers more quickly and more cost effectively. And so it looks like Target is leaning into this strategy by creating these local delivery hubs. And it's a really different strategy. I mean, you could kind of compare and contrast, not to get too in the weeds, but, you know, Amazon has built this vast supply chain network with lots of distribution centers in major metro areas that allows them to do same day and next day. Most other e-commerce companies rely on regional distribution centers and are shipping most of their product through the mail, which makes it impossible to do same day. and makes it quite costly to even do next day. And Target has really adopted this kind of blend, which I think is super interesting. I think Walmart is largely following in their footsteps. So Best Buy is a little bit different deal. And I was doing a little bit more research on this before we got on air. So they announced, Best Buy announced that they, I guess it's been open now about 10 days. They open a small store in the suburbs of Charlotte, only about 5,000 square feet. So quite a bit smaller than a typical Best Buy store. And it's called a digital first store. And I think they're doing what we've seen, particularly in China, with having stores that are basically, you know, integrated with an app that you use to conduct a lot of the services, get information, log in for loyalty programs, those sort of things. So that's not wholly new. But the other thing they're doing in Charlotte, and this is the thing I didn't pick up until I did a little bit more research, is they're actually testing a bunch of different formats throughout the Charlotte market. So they opened an outlet store. They opened a more upscale, or I guess they renovated an existing store to be a more upscale experiential store. So what I think they're doing, which I would really encourage other retailers to look at, is to really think about their deployment. And we talked about this in the hybridization reconfiguration episodes last season, I guess that was, of, you know, how do you reconfigure your market to meet the customers where they are, deal with the blurring between physical and digital. I almost said digital.
Oh my God. There's a penalty for that,
There's a penalty for that. Yes. I got to put $10 into a jar. And, you know, and also, as we talked about with Target, figure out the best way to have customers get the product, whether they want that shipped to their home or they want to pick it up or just go into the store and take it home with them. So I think it's a really interesting portfolio strategy that they're putting into place. And I think we're going to see, and I know we're going to talk about this some more in a few weeks, you know, what is the role of small stores, particularly for some of these large retailers, you know, retailers that are large in their total size, but also have historically relied on very, very big stores that were really built for a different age. And how are they going to reposition and reconfigure themselves to be successful? So I think the store format itself is interesting, but maybe even more interesting is what does this say for their portfolio approach going forward? And they're very public. If you go on their website, we'll put a link in the show notes as to what they're doing there and what this is all about, which is interesting to see.
Also in the news, late breaking news today, Amazon hoovers up, so to speak, a vacuum company. I was a bit, in one way, I was taken surprised by this. On another way, it reminded me of the last time I was in the Soho 4-star store. These folks had a huge display, so clearly there was already a relationship. Tell the listeners what you're thinking about the iRobot acquisition.
Yeah, I did not have this on my dance card. This I think, like you, kind of surprised me. But as I'm sure many of our listeners know, Amazon's got a very big position already in a number of connected devices. You know, the home security device. They've got the little robot. Yeah, they've already got a bunch of connected devices, and this will be another part of their portfolio. So,
connected we're over home, I guess. Yeah. How much was it?
I think it was $1.7 billion or something. I don't have that in front of me, but it was
no muffins for Tuesday at Amazon.
Well, you know, on the one hand, that's a good amount of money. On the other hand, for Amazon, it's kind of pocket change.
It's muffin money.
You know, I think, again, it gets back to things we've touched on, you know, in the last episode, but many episodes before. You know, thinking of Amazon as a retail company in the more traditional sense is just really misguided. You know, they're in so many different things. You know, I almost forgot that they were doing all that. Like, oh, it's part of their connected devices. And I'm like, oh, yeah, they got a lot of, they've got, you know, the Alexa and they've got Ring and they've got, you know, so that business by itself would be a pretty sizable business, I would imagine. But it almost gets lost. I also, there was some news about adding value or adding new services to their Prime package. And in that article, it said that, you know, Amazon has close to 200 million Prime members paying in the new, in most markets, paying $139. And I was doing a little bit of math on how much money that is, just the revenue from Prime subscriptions, you know, and it's bigger than most retailers in the world, right? Just by itself. So yeah, Amazon is such a diverse, interesting company where all these things are, or many of these things are really tied together into the famous flywheel effect. So we'll see. I guess they basically made iRobot kind of like a private brand for them now.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Let's see if Alexa is connected to iRobot. Hey, Alexa, Run my iRobot for me.
Did you mean family room?
Oh, no. Alexa does not know what I'm talking about, but I'm sure it will soon. I love my iRobot, actually. I'm a big fan of the company, and good for Amazon. That's a neat acquisition. All right, well, that's a wrap on our news of the week. Now, just before we get to our excellent interview with Christine, let's hear from our presenting sponsor, Marketile. Marketile's easy-to-use testing platform emboldens great decisions, leading to reliable, scalable results. With Marketile, you can be confident in the outcome of your in-store pilot initiatives before rolling them out across your fleet. In a challenging retail climate of supply chain disruption, labor shortages, and dynamic customer behavior, the need for reliable insights has never been greater. Validate your remarkable ideas with Marketile's in-store testing solution. The proof is in the testing. Learn more at Marketile.com. That's Marketile.com.
Well, we are delighted to welcome Christine Day to the podcast. Welcome, Christine. How are you doing today?
I'm great. It's sunny here in Seattle, and it doesn't get much better than that.
All right. Well, I am in Dallas, and it's boiling hot, so I don't want to hear about the better weather you're probably having. But thanks for joining us. What we usually like to do before we jump into our litany of questions is just have our guests tell us a little bit about their professional and personal journey. So why don't we start there, if you don't mind?
Well, great. Let's see. I graduated with a degree in business and IT, and I went to work in the financial industry and private placement offerings. And doing that, I came across a gentleman named Howard Schultz, who asked me to help with his private placement offering for his concept, Il Giornale, which was a small coffee shop. And this was back in 1986 at this point. And so I went to work for him. He had one coffee shop at the time, doing about $400,000 in sales. We ended up doing three fundraising rounds and bought Starbucks. And so then we had about, I think it was around...
Whatever happened to them, by the way?
That could be something someday, right?
Yeah. So let's see. So we had 13 stores when I started. And when I left, after 20 years, we were almost a $8 billion business, and I was running 10 countries in Asia Pacific and led the company-owned operations into China, and spending about 320 nights a year on airplanes and hotel rooms. So that kind of got old. So then I made the decision to leave and see what else Christine could do. And so then I ended up at Lululemon Athletica as CEO, and they were about 7 months a public company at that point, around $200 million in revenue. And over the next 6 years, we grew that to about $1.6 billion. That was quite a rocket ride. Then I started a food as medicine company, so that sells food to insurance companies for people with hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, et cetera, and actually as a benefit under Medicare or Medicaid, where people actually get, between 200 and more meals delivered to their home. So that's rolling out now. I left that a couple of years ago and started the House of LRNC, which stands for the House of Love, Respect, and Care, with Russell Wilson and his wife, Sierra. And that's all about sustainable fashion. So that's kind of the cliff note journey. It's incredible. I've had a good time in my professional career, let's just say that.
Yeah, I mean, that's some amazing experience. One of the reasons we wanted you on the podcast is Michael and I heard you at Shop Talk, and I was just kind of blown away. I mean, it's super interesting about what you're doing now, which we're about to get to, but also just this incredible journey working with two just iconic brands at really critical times in their growth trajectory. So maybe we'll come back to some leadership lessons from that. But tell us about this House of LRNC and how that all came about, and what really the company is or the brand is.
So great. Well, it stands for the House of Love, Respect, and Care. It also stands for Love, Russell, and Sierra. And so it started out with the Goodman brand, which is a men's clothing line, which was sold at Nordstrom's. Russell started that with some partners. He asked me to take a look at it, and it didn't really have much presence or, you know, any business operations outside of Nordstrom. So I helped build a DTC business and kind of really rebranded it and then moved it into the sustainability space. And then Russell, of course, married Sierra and he said, okay, well, Sierra would like a brand. And so the next thing I knew, I was developing Lita, which is Love is the Answer by Sierra, and Human Nation, which is our gender neutral Gen Z brand. And the whole purpose of the house and the brands is really to elevate the fashion industry, which is one of the third dirtiest industries in the world and really behind other industries, including the food industry, in terms of transitioning into not just sustainability, but all ESG practices. So your environmental, social, governance, you know, has a lot of room to level up, as Sierra would say. And so that was really the mission, is to make sustainable fashion the effortless choice for the consumer by offering them brands they love. And they just have to love the clothing, and we've taken care of everything else. So we formed as a public benefit corp. And then we received our B Corp certification within about 18 months of opening, because we really designed the company right from the beginning to meet the UN sustainability and transparency goals, to meet the B Corp standards, to, you know, get certifications like the Leatherworks, standard gold, which is what all of our leather product is made to, and responsible wool standard. We looked at the textile exchanges, top rated fabrics. So we really are a fabric first company. So we start with that, where it's made, then, you know, pick B Corps and sustainable green factories to manufacture in. Then all the way, we call it the true line. So from purpose and mission all the way through our operating principles to our impact across the whole organization, to really create value by living values. So, you know, that's really what we're up to. And the medium, of course, is clothing. But it's really about, you know, giving people the choice and showing that you can still build a great business model, even though, you know, you are a sustainable, you know, company. And so far, it's working. So we're pretty excited about it. That's right.
That. Yeah, fantastic.
And maybe before, I don't want to get too in the weeds on, you know, like the technicalities of a B Corp, but could you just maybe touch on why that's so important to what you're doing, and maybe some of the challenges it puts on building a and growing a profitable brand?
Yeah, I mean, number one, it's a very, you know, complex, you know, document and application process. You know, the average score of people who apply the first time is 50. We got a score of 94.9, you know, which puts us in, you know, the ranks of companies who's been doing it. You know, they're probably on their third or fourth renewal, because you have to improve 20% every time. But what, you know, is important about B Corps is it's a third party verification of everything you do across that ESG spectrum. So, so we can't just make random claims. We have to back everything up from our environmental claims with measurements, with reports, with third-party audits, you know, same thing on your social programs. And then governance is important too. So it's, you know, one of the few you know, certified programs from ESG. There are other ones that measure what you're doing and you report against, but being able to use that certification in your marketing, advertising. So if you looked at our recently opened Denver store, we have big old B Corp sign in the window. And really, that's also part about educating consumers as well. So it keeps us honest. And, you know, I think that's what's really important. You know, the supply chain in this industry is, you know, is kind of archaic in a lot of ways. You know, even though it's global in terms of measuring impact and moving in with kind of like all the things from ESG that you want to be able to measure. So, you know, there are things like the HIG index, which is controversial right now, which I think is a shame, because, you know, reality is anybody who's measuring anything will get better and we'll learn more and, you know, we'll adjust what we think good is as an industry, but we've got to start measuring. So B Corp is one of those things that really does apply. And there are not very many apparel companies that have B Corp status. So we're really proud of it.
So I guess it's like the ISO 9000 or 9001 standards, right? The fact that you nailed it on the first try tells me you architected the business in such a way, oriented in the built for good and what the standards of the B Corp were. What came first for you? Was it the commercial opportunity, or was it the idea or the ethics or the concept of being built for good? How did you approach that, and why did it matter for you, and why do you think it matters to us?
Well, honestly, I wouldn't have done this unless Russell and Sierra had agreed, you know, to do it as a public benefit corp and a B Corp. And the public benefit corp is really important in today's world, in the U.S. in particular. The Canadian model is much more about you can, as a corporation, you can take all stakeholders into account. In the U.S., we've shifted so much by the activist investors and case law to, you know, short-term results and, you know, what's in the best interest of the shareholders at that particular moment. And versus like the long-term health of companies and how they create value across the value chain and sustainable value. And I don't mean just sustainability. I mean that is a sustainable economic chain. So, you know, for me in doing business, what I really wanted to do was make sure that anything I do, it makes the world a better place. You know, I'm at that point, you know, I'm 60.
Sure.
You know, you kind of, you know, you've accomplished a lot. You know, I've had the CEO title. I've, you know, done a lot of great things. But, you know, it's about how do you teach that next generation we can do business with values and we can return capital to shareholders and play the long game across the environment, the social causes, and then governance for shareholders. So, you know, it was really, you know, if this will, I doubt it'll be the last thing I do, but I want to do something really meaningful that shows the path. You know, I call it creating the type of company the future needs now.
Yeah, consumers are a bit of a paradox, right? I mean, it seems to me sometimes they talk about they're all about sustainability and issues, yet I look on the App Store and I see, you know, retailers like Shein being a number one downloaded app, which is probably the opposite end of what you're doing. Like, how do you think through that? What's your lens when you think about consumers and their actual behavior versus their stated behavior?
Well, I think the gap in the fashion industry and sustainability has been, and all due respect, like I love brands like Patagonia and Pangaea and brands that have been, you know, Everlane that have been, you know, moving in the sustainable direction. But the thing they don't give the consumer is true fashion. And we're not going to change this industry unless we actually give them true fashion plus true sustainability. They have to love the piece. Mm. And then price is an important component of it, you know, so that's why we also did the Human Nation brand, which is our most affordable. So like a hoodie at $78, which has a DWR wash on it, which is a durable water resistance. We call it Drip Shield, that makes the garment water resistant, stain resistant, anti-stink. So it's wear more, wash less for $78 with a really good gram weight in it. You know, so that kind of price point makes it really affordable for the consumer, and it's organic cotton and recycled poly mix. There, the consumer just has to love that sweatshirt. It's affordable. And then, you know, then we're going to change the behavior. But fashion in particular, clothing is people's emotional armor. Like if we're going to a wedding or an event or going back to school, we want new clothes, right? And we want to express ourselves. It's a form of art for many people. So, you know, that's where we have to get the emotional side of fashion right with sustainability. And that's really what we're trying to do here at the house.
You've led hyper growth organizations, Starbucks, Lululemon. What's the growth strategy for this brand? You're online, direct to consumer. I think you're wholesale. And I think you've got some physical stores. How do you see this evolving? What's the 1 + 1 = 3? And what are the roadblocks or challenges? We see some, you know, digital native vertical brands struggling these days, and many are going to mix their how they go to market. What's your approach?
Yeah, I really believe in the omnichannel approach because it's where the consumer's at. And, you know, in today's market, like I always look at it and I think, you know, when I built Lululemon, you know, it was kind of what I'd call the rise of the mono brands and the first merger of kind of e-commerce plus your digital footprint. And we were doing it, your physical footprint, and we were doing it right at the stage of growth. So I was able to plan my digital footprint and my physical footprint at the same time, which a lot of the big traditional mono brands didn't really have that opportunity with DTC, and they were kind of overbuilt in stores. You know, and wholesale wasn't something that we did because it was really, you know, in the days of like JCPenney's and Macy's in that heyday, they were discounting like crazy, which ultimately, ruined them. And so any wholesaler, any mono brand that sold to them, you couldn't control your price in the market. But in today's world, and then of course you had DTC only for a while. But now you've got really this consolidation with Google, Facebook, or Meta, we should say now, and kind of an oligopoly. I mean, yeah, you've got TikTok, but the cost of digital advertising has soared. So, you know, you had brands that might have had good gross margins, but shipping costs have soared, digital costs have soared. So it's not as an attractive business model. And the thing about doing a small amount of wholesale strategically is it allows your business model to hit a better gross margin because you hit, you know, your fabric minimums, and you have a consistent base as long as you choose your partners wisely. You don't oversell and overbuy, so you get left holding the bag with inventory, and then having you get brand awareness so you can grow your own DTC channels. But people still love the art of shopping. I don't think, you know, we can grow as many stores as maybe brands have historically in the past. But, you know, smart stores where the social aspect of shopping, tying things on, the guest experience are important. But I think we'll see smaller stores and more integrated stores, which is why we've used things like Flow Codes, where you can, you can shop off our mannequins. If the store's closed, you can see with a Flow Code, which goes to an internet light landing page as opposed to just a website. You can follow links. You can see our sustainability story. So, you know, I think the theater of shopping is still important. And then a seamless guest experience to shop online, keeping your stores kind of inventory light, delivered to stores. So that omni shopping experience is critical to today's world. So that's what we're doing. And, you know, we're growing at, you know, our own channels at about 110% right now. So in spite of, I think, the consumer slowdown, you know, we feel pretty good about how our business has been responded to, and, you know, the brand stories that we're telling. Certainly does not hurt to have people like Russell and Sierra posting date, having, yeah, you know, 1500 extra customer, you know, percent increase in customer traffic. I hope that we, you know, we're going to be one of those growth success stories. We're certainly working very hard to make that happen.
Well, I love the way you've kind of pulled together this, you know, this decades long experience of how brands have grown with kind of the current trends of using social media and sustainability and all those kinds of things. I'm kind of curious. I know we've just got another couple minutes left. If we want to draw some lessons from your experience over the years for some broader leadership lessons for people that are listening, are there any other points you would make about how to tap into human potential or just in general lead in what's, you know, a pretty complicated and ever-changing environment?
I always look at it as like, no matter where I am, which is, you know, why I think I was successful in Asia as well, where you've got maybe, you know, $2.40 labor in Thailand, and in Australia, you've got $29 labor, and you've got to create the same guest experience and brand experience, but you've got a completely different Lego kit, you know, color set. So it's like, how do you put the building blocks together, you know, every time is one of the ways that I always look at business. But the second is really that whole, you know, purpose-led journey, and when people come to work for you because they love the purpose and passion, that ability to overcome problems and think in new critical ways is, you know, as a team is so important. So being purpose-led and then keeping that purpose and that those values through all of your operating systems as you design them is so critical. But, you know, the last is, you know, I've been part of a lot of, you know, good entrepreneurial ideas. But if you don't shift from just ideas and concept and passion into scalable working business models, you need the technical expertise. You need to give the shareholders a return on their money. You've got to work on things like gross margin and product costs. And, you know, you have to shift from a kind of heroic muscle through things to planning for success as the business gets more complex. So, you know, for a lot of the early founders, you've got to manage risk as much as you manage opportunity, and you've got to manage risk as much as you manage your passion. And that's where I think a lot of young entrepreneurs not valuing or respecting really how hard it is to create a business model that works. And you've got to have that industry experience. Even though maybe you want to do things differently, you still have to compete in the business world.
Well, it's been such a treat catching up with you. I mean, I think we could talk for a long time about this. So you touch on so many things that the paradoxes of choice and the course of modern retail. It's really amazing to see I wouldn't call it a celebrity brand, but you really matched together the skill of being a merchant and the panache of a brand. As you said, it's that solution, right? How do we get people that and or, but it is that both and thinking. So, you know, thanks so much for joining us on the Remarkable Retail Podcast. Been a real treat to chat with you, and I wish you continued success. Now, are you a LinkedIn person? What's the best way to kind of keep up with what's going on with your brand?
Well, I think I use LinkedIn as a social media channel. So I'm always blasting on that. So, well, thank you for having me, though. It was a real pleasure to have the conversation and to share just, you know, a little bit of how I think about retail. So thank you so much.
If you like what you heard, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, your favorite podcast platform, so you can catch up with all our great interviews, like our discussion with Seth Godin on what retailers can actually do to fight climate change. New episodes of Season 5, presented by Marketel, will show up each and every week. And be sure and tell your friends and colleagues in the retail industry all about us.
And I'm Steve Dennis, author of the best-selling book, Remarkable Retail, How to Win and Keep Customers in the Age of Disruption. You can learn more about me, my consulting, and keynote speaking at stephenpdennis.com.
And I'm Michael LeBlanc, consumer retail growth consultant, keynote speaker, and producer and host of a series of retail trade podcasts, including this one, plus the host of the popular YouTube cooking show, Last Request Barbecue. You can learn even more about me on LinkedIn or meleblanc.co. Safe travels, everyone.